and welcome to Background Briefing, available 24/7 at backgroundbriefing.org. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll examine a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with Facebook shares plunging 18% on Thursday, wiping over $118 billion off Facebook's market capitalization and crimping Mark Zuckerberg's personal fortune by $16 billion. We'll speak with Barry Lynn, the executive director of the Open Markets Institute, about his article at The Guardian, "Google and Facebook are strangling the free press to death. Democracy is the loser." We'll discuss Google and Facebook's relationship to this week's firing of half of the staff of the New York Daily News and the dangers posed by these monopolies, who are the gatekeepers of the news for 93% of Americans. And then with the Federal District Court in Maryland ruling that the emoluments case against Donald Trump by the Attorneys General of the District of Columbia and Maryland can move forward, we will speak with the author of the amicus brief, which is credited with providing the definition of emoluments applying to the president as any profit, gain, or advantage, and that the historical purpose of the emoluments clause is to function as a broad anti-corruption provision. John Mikhail, a professor of law and associate dean at Georgetown University School of Law, joins us to discuss the efforts by Trump's lawyers and the DOJ to dismiss the case, which hinges on the legal interpretation of the emoluments clause and whether they apply to the president. Now that the attorneys general of the District of Columbia and Maryland have been given a ruling by federal district judge Peter Macit that their lawsuit against the president can move forward, we will look into Trump's apparent violation of the Constitution as he continues to do business with foreign and domestic governments and the historical nature of a federal judge for the first time ruling on what the word in the Constitution, emolument, means. Then finally, we'll get an analysis of the consequences for students with an insurmountable debt burden and worthless diplomas from fraudulent for-profit colleges in the proposal put forward by Education Secretary Betsy DeVos to require that defrauded student borrowers seeking loan forgiveness prove that these colleges deceive them. Aaron Ament, president of the National Student Legal Defense Network, who served as chief of staff of the United States Department of Education's Office of the General Counsel, joins us to discuss how DeVos has surrounded herself with top advisors who are former executives from for-profit colleges who had to pay settlements for defrauding students while saddling them with a lifetime of debt. And joining us now is Barry Lynn, the executive director of the Open Markets Institute, who previously spent 15 years at the New America Foundation researching and writing about monopoly power. He's the author of Cornered, The New Monopoly Capitalism and the Economics of Destruction and End of the Line, The Rise and Coming Fall of the Global Corporation. And he has an article at The Guardian, "Google and Facebook are strangling the free press to death. Democracy is the loser." Welcome to Background Briefing, Barry Lynn.
Thank you for having me.
And before we get to discuss your article, Barry, today on the stock exchange, $118 billion was wiped off Facebook's market capitalization, meaning that the founder, Mark Zuckerberg, took a personal hit of $16 billion loss on his personal fortune. So this amounts to an 18% drop in their price in one day. So something's happening out there, and I believe it has a lot to do with the fact that Facebook had to reveal that 3 million users in Europe had abandoned the social network since revelations about Cambridge Analytica's breach became public. So what's your understanding about what's happening there in terms of people abandoning Facebook?
Well, I think it's absolutely what you said. I mean, the investors are finally coming to grips with the fact that Facebook is losing users, and actually, it's not just losing users in Europe. There's been a real shift in the United States as well. And actually, the numbers would look much worse if Facebook wasn't a monopoly. We know from our own work that a lot of the people who've tried to get off Facebook have switched over to sort of other brands such as Instagram or WhatsApp, both of which happen to be owned by Facebook. So even people who are trying to get away from Facebook without necessarily understanding it are ending up back on the Facebook platform just under a different name. the other thing that we think is happening is that investors are starting to wake up to the fact that that Facebook's problems are not over. The U.S. Congress is planning more hearings. We should actually expect a number of more hearings on Facebook. Regulators at the FTC and the DOJ and the SEC are all looking at Facebook. The Europeans, both at the sort of the federal level in Brussels and at the state level in Paris and Berlin, are looking at Facebook. So there's a lot of regulatory actions that are probably coming down the pike, any of which could have a quite large effect on Facebook's prospects.
So there's also been some negative publicity recently. Zuckerberg rather inartfully tried to excuse having Holocaust deniers being given a platform. And then there's been a lot of pressure against Alex Jones of InfoWars because he's obviously completely insane. He's being sued by the families of the children who were slaughtered at Sandy Hook, which he says was a false flag operation done by the United States government. Now he's on a tear accusing special counsel Robert Mueller of being a child rapist. And yet nothing is done about his YouTube sites, which Google owns, and his Facebook activities. And it's pretty extraordinary that Mark Zuckerberg, the best he can say is that the approach that we've taken to false news is not to say you can't say something wrong on the internet. Everyone gets things wrong. And if we're taking down people's accounts when they get a few things wrong, then that would be a hard world for giving people a voice and saying that you care about that. So I don't know. I can't follow that particularly, but it seems like a cop-out to me.
Yeah, I mean, we here at Open Markets, I mean, we're not advocating the censorship of any particular outlet. That's a two-edged sword, you know. And if we start sort of, you know, shutting down, you know, the crazy folks on the right, you know, then we could maybe see people, crazy folks on the left, and actually one day we'll wake up and it's actually not the crazy folks that are getting shut down. So we don't advocate any kind of shutting down of anybody by Google or Facebook. They're simply too powerful. If you're cut off from these platforms, then actually, that's a death sentence for most, publications. And what we do advocate in the case of both Google and Facebook and places, you know, is a better policing of their sites to really take down some of this apparatus, this kind of fake apparatus that has been built by various types of hackers and propagandists to game their sites and create sort of false virality and push stuff out there at a speed that it shouldn't be pushed out there. So we think that there's a big difference between slowing down the false virality that is sort of engineered by certain actors into the system that we support, but sort of censorship of anybody, we think that's more problematic. We think that that can be avoided, however.
And how do you avoid it?
A lot of it, this is the what I was trying to get to at with this article on The Guardian today. The way that you avoid it is actually by taking away from Google and Facebook the licenses, the legal licenses that they enjoy to use their power in ways that degrade the trustworthy journalism, that sort of steer eyeballs away from trustworthy journalism. I mean, the one of the main problems that we see in the United States today, and to a lesser extent around the world, is that Facebook and Google are stealing all of the advertising. It's like since the beginning of this country, going back to the 18th century, newspapers were supported by advertising and by local advertising. Now, Google and Facebook are not the only reason that local advertising has collapsed. Has gone down to a very large degree. Part of that's just because we've allowed so much concentration to take place over the last 30 years. But Google and Facebook are exploiting their positions. as the intermediaries, the people who intermediate in between you, the reader, and the reporters and publishers and editors on whom you depend. They're taking advantage of that position as intermediary to steer the advertising away from the publisher and into their own pockets.
And again, I'm speaking with Barry Lynn, who's the executive director of the Open Markets Institute, who previously spent 15 years at the New America Foundation researching and writing about monopoly power. He's the author of Cornered, The New Monopoly Capitalism and the Economics of Destruction, and End of the Line, The Rise and Coming Fall of the Global Corporation. And he has an article at The Guardian. Google and Facebook are strangling the free press to death. Democracy is the loser. Well, I don't understand how you get a free pass like this. You know, you're the piano player in the whorehouse. You know, I'm sorry. I'm not responsible for what people say on my platform. I mean, if the New York Times or the Associated Press printed the kind of crazy stuff that Alex Jones printed, they'd be out of business in a heartbeat. So is it a societal problem that we no longer have any kind of consensus in this country anymore about what is true and what is real?
No, I mean, that's a great question. I mean, what we're really looking at here is that we're just, as a society, our regulators are not treating Google and Facebook the way we treated previous communications platforms. You know, in many respects, you look at Facebook and what you see is a 21st century version of AT&T. You know, this is how we can connect with one another. It's like telephone calls with all these added extras that, you know, allow us to communicate in additional ways. But now when you go back to the 20th century and you look at AT&T, what you see is a set of regulations that would say, for instance, and this is, you know, you will not listen in on people's phone calls, and you will not use your knowledge about what people are doing to try and sell them things. Now, so those were laws on the books. Those were regulations on the books. And that was to ensure that AT&T provided simple services to all comers and that allowed them to go about their business. Now, what is Facebook today? Facebook, what's their business model? Their business model is to listen in on your phone calls and then to use that information, those secrets that they have gathered, to manipulate you through manipulative advertising. And then they pocket the money from that advertising. I mean, Facebook, last year, almost all their money comes from advertising revenue, $40 billion last year. With Google, $95 billion of advertising revenue went into their pockets last year. It's the only thing they make money off of is advertising. These are giant advertising operations. When what they should be doing is just providing us simple services.
Well, the business model is referred to as surveillance capitalism, and you think that that would get people's attention. And in your article, Barry Lynn, Google and Facebook are strangling the free press to death. Democracy is a loser. You refer to this week's firing of half of the staff of the New York Daily News. So I'd like to get your opinion on Facebook's relationship to that event and also to the dangers posed by these monopolies, who are the gatekeepers of the news for what your article says is 93% of Americans. Is that accurate?
We said 93% of the Americans get some of their news through social media. More than half actually get most of their news, connect with most of the articles they read on social media. Those numbers are growing. The dangers, there's a couple of dangers that are wrapped up here. One of the fundamental dangers is that we're seeing this collapse of local journalism. Now, Google and Facebook are not the only reasons that we've seen a collapse of local journalism. We saw, you know, when Craigslist came along 20 years ago, what happened is the back end of newspapers, the classified advertising sections, which they had used to subsidize their news gathering, classified ad business collapsed, you know, beginning 20 years ago and really accelerating, say, about 15 years ago, just vanished. You know, that had an effect on local newspapers. But the thing is that by about, you know, 2006, 2007, we saw local newspapers really sort of start to stabilize their operations. But then they sort of hit stage two of the internet, and that's where Google and Facebook came in. Google and Facebook really starting in 2006, 2007, 2008, you know, with in the case of Google, with the purchase of DoubleClick, with the purchase of AdMob, they really started to double down on their efforts to monopolize advertising in the United States. And that's where their money is coming from. It's their efforts to monopolize advertising. And that advertising it's not new advertising. It's coming from somewhere. They're stripping that advertising out of other people's magazines, other people's newspapers. So this collapse in the number of local journalists, the number of journalists who are covering City Hall, covering the state capitol, you know, sort of checking up on the local police forces. You know, it's like we need journalists in our country just to protect us from various forms of abuse by government, by large corporations. The number of journalists that are available, especially at the local level, they're being choked off because the advertising that has traditionally supported their salaries is being stripped away. It's being stolen. It's being pocketed by super giant communications monopolies, Google and Facebook. And again, we can talk about this perhaps, but there's really easy fixes for this. This is not something new. We've faced this before. And in our regulatory toolkit here in the United States, we have all the tools we need to fix this.
Well, it's worth pointing out that Facebook and Google, who are immensely rich, and if Zuckerberg lost $16 billion today off his fortune, fortune's God knows what's $60, $70 billion in any case. But they don't spend a dime on investigative journalists in small towns figuring out what the local council is up to or what abuses are going on in the local jail. Is there any way to appeal to them and make them understand how society is being hurt by this evisceration of journalism?
You know, at Open Markets, you know, at our organization here, we believe that the American citizenry should never, ever be in a position where we feel obliged to appeal to the whims, to the, you know, to the
altruism, right?
It's like the corporations exist to serve our interests. We grant licenses to these corporations. They don't exist, you know, we do not grant them licenses to rule over us. We grant them licenses to serve us, to bring us, you know, to sort of better technologies, to bring us better networks. And we allow the people who do this to be rewarded in phenomenal ways. When you bring something really great to market, I mean, let's be honest, Google, the search engine and the mapping, I mean, those are great technologies and they deserve a lot of reward for bringing those technologies to market. They serve us. But when they bring those technologies to market, that's all they deserve. They deserve the financial reward, but they do not have a license that comes with that to rule us, to use those technologies to rule over us, to tell journalists what to write, to steer profits within a journalistic system to certain publications and not to other publications. They are not allowed to discriminate. And this goes back to the founding of our nation. There have been monopolies in our nation from the very beginning. It's like we have to remember that the very first communications monopoly was the postal system. And we established all of these rules on the postal system to ensure that they carried every newspaper from whatever point anyone wanted to send it to whatever other point. That was the original system of communications to move news around and information around from city to city, from person to person. We know how to do this. We did this for more than 200 years. Google and Facebook are the first communications corporations in the history of the United States that have not been subject to basic rules limiting how they manipulate journalists and newspapers.
Well, just in closing, they have the ability, not only are they bleeding revenues, but they also, you said a minute ago, that they have the ability to pick and choose, and they could basically shut down a newspaper or build up another one, or I suppose any other media asset as well, right? So how does media in this country survive looking over their shoulder at the power of these monopolies to put them out of business?
Well, you know, we've actually seen the newspapers are starting to stand up. The big newspapers are starting to stand up. The New York Times and the Boston Globe have called for the breakup of Google. We ran an event on June 12th here in Washington, and we had the CEO of News Corp, which publishes the Wall Street Journal, which owns Fox Television. We had the CEO of News Corp up on stage with the CEO of the New York Times, and they agreed with one another that Facebook and Google must be dealt with. And they agreed that one thing that should never happen is we should never allow Facebook and Google to choose what journalism we see. So what we're seeing right now for the first time are the mainstream journalists standing up to fight. So we're going to win this. We're absolutely going to win this fight. The American people have been doing this for 250 years. We've been actually, if you go back to John Milton and Areopagitica, which was an article which he wrote in the 1640s about the free press, we've been doing this for nigh on 400 years, and we are not going to let the boys who run Google and Facebook change that. But it is a fight, and we have to fight that fight right now.
Well, Barry Lynn, I thank you very much for joining us here today.
Hey, thank you for having me.
And again, I've been speaking with Barry Lynn, who's Executive Director of the Open Markets Institute, who previously spent 15 years at the New America Foundation researching and writing about monopoly power. He's the author of Cornered, The New Monopoly Capitalism, and The Economics of Destruction, and End of the Line, The Rise and Coming Fall of the Global Corporation. And he has an article at The Guardian, Google and Facebook are strangling the free press to death. Democracy is the loser. We can take a brief station break. We're back looking into Trump's apparent violation of the Constitution as he continues to do business with foreign and domestic governments, and the historical nature of a federal judge for the first time ruling on what the word in the Constitution, emolument, means. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at backgroundbriefing.org. And joining us now is John McKyle, who's a professor of law and associate dean at Georgetown University School of Law, whose research focuses on constitutional law, criminal law, torts, international law, jurisprudence, moral and legal philosophy, legal history, and cognitive science. He previously served as a judicial clerk on the U.S. Court of Appeals for the 11th Circuit, and he has most recently co-authored an amicus brief in the District of Columbia and State of Maryland versus Trump emoluments case. Welcome to Background Briefing, John McKyle.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be with you.
Well, thank you, John. And I understand that the amicus brief that you and Jed Sugarman did has been credited with providing the definition of emoluments applying to the president as any profit, gain, or advantage, and that the historical purpose of the emoluments clause is to function as a broad anti-corruption provision. And this is significant because there's never been a ruling by a federal judge in our history, or anybody for that matter, to provide a definition for what the word in the Constitution, emolument, means.
That's correct. Let me start by just clarifying that there were several other authors on our amicus brief. In addition to Jed Sugarman at Fordham Law School, we had Gautam Rao, who's a historian here at American University in Washington, D.C. Simon Stern is a law professor at the University of Toronto, and Jack Rakoff is an historian at Stanford University. So there were five of us on the brief, and we did, in fact, make the argument that you described. We wanted to provide the court with the benefit of our research into the original meaning of the word emolument. It's a term that's obviously fallen out of use in ordinary English today, but at the time the Constitution was written and ratified, it was a more common term. If you look into the correspondence of the founders or some of the public laws that they adopted in addition to the Constitution, you find this term, and it typically operated in the way that you described. That is to say, it was part of provisions of public law that were designed to prevent office holders from profiting off of their office and to ensure that they were working in the public benefit. So they were principles of republican government in the 18th century sense of that term.
So, of course, the other people involved along with Crewe are the Attorneys General of the District of Columbia and Maryland. And I suppose it's worth noting that there are two emoluments clauses. One, I could read it very quickly. The Foreign Emoluments Clause provides that no person holding any office for profit or trust under the United States shall, without the consent of the Congress, accept of any present emolument, office, or title of any kind whatever from any king, prince, or foreign state. And then the Domestic Emoluments Clause says the president shall, at stated times, receive for his services a compensation which shall neither be increased nor diminished during the period for which he shall have been elected, and he shall not receive within the period any other emolument from the United States or any of them. So I suppose just from reading the two emoluments clauses, both apply to Donald Trump in terms of the hotel there in Washington, which is leased from the government because it has foreign guests, and also, for example, the governor of Maine recently stayed there with a large delegation.
That's correct. So Donald Trump, as your listeners surely will know, maintains a vast global and domestic business empire. Many businesses fall under the umbrella of the Trump Organization. He and the companies primarily, but he derivatively as the owner of the companies, is engaged in commercial transactions with many different market participants. Most of those are probably not governments. So there are other companies, there are individuals. Those transactions are not at issue in these lawsuits. The two clauses that you described and that you read, importantly, refer only to the receipt of emoluments or profits, gains, advantages, and benefits by a federal official, including the president, from governments. So the Domestic Emoluments Clause pertains to transactions with either the United States, the federal government, or the individual states. And the Foreign Emoluments Clause applies to transactions with foreign governments, not with foreign corporations. So there's no particular problem, for example, if Deutsche Bank or a Chinese bank or some other independent private corporation were to engage in transactions with the Trump administration. The problem that arises with these provisions is when state-owned banks, and there are, of course, state-owned banks in China, state-owned banks or state-owned agencies or the government itself is contracting with the Trump Organization. As you mentioned, the Trump Hotel is an obvious locus of activity in this regard. It's a mere stone's throw from the White House. We have pretty good evidence that foreign dignitaries, emissaries from various foreign governments are not only staying at the Trump Hotel and doing business with the Trump Hotel, but doing so overtly to curry favor with the president. And that's some of the most salient type of violation that really concerns people. It really seems like provisions that were designed to prevent corruption, prevent just this type of behavior in which the profit-seeking motive of a federal official comes into conflict with his public duties, that's in fact what is happening now. And it's an obvious source of concern to many Americans.
And again, I'm speaking with John Mikhail, a professor of law and associate dean at Georgetown University School of Law, whose research focuses on constitutional law, international law, jurisprudence, moral and legal philosophy, legal history, and cognitive science. He previously served as a judicial clerk on the U.S. Court of Appeals for the 11th Circuit, and he most recently co-authored an amicus brief in the District of Columbia and the State of Maryland versus Trump emoluments case. So from my understanding of what Trump's lawyers and the DOJ have been arguing is that somehow the emoluments clause doesn't apply to the president because he can't profit from anything he basically does as an individual. However, he has his sons and his family and a whole bunch of people working for him, and they apparently can go off and profit. And this has led legal scholar Jane Chong to say that you might call this a constitutional free pass for super rich presidents. Is that a fair summary?
I think it's a fair summary. So I want to clarify one point. There are three different lawsuits in federal court right now against the president. One is the one you referred to, the Crew versus Trump. That's actually not the particular lawsuit that was decided just this week by Judge Massetti in the District Court of Maryland. The Crew case is up in the Southern District of New York, and it's currently on appeal because the district judge in that case, accepted the president's arguments that the case ought to be dismissed and issued a ruling to that effect. And the plaintiffs, Crew, which a public watchdog organization, is they're appealing that case. The case yesterday was decided, and it involved the case decided by Judge Massetti yesterday was the one brought by the District of Columbia and by the State of Maryland. And then there's a third case that has been brought by members of Congress. In fact, I believe it's approximately 200 members of Congress. Virtually every Democratic member of the Congress has filed suit against the president. And that case has yet to be decided in the first instance on both the question of the standing of those plaintiffs to bring suit and also this merits question of the meaning of the clause and whether it applies to the president. To go to your question, the president and his lawyers from the start of this controversy, even before the lawsuits were brought, in fact, even before the president was inaugurated, his lawyers who worked at a private law firm issued a white paper, sort of a position paper. And their position was, and his position continues to be, that the clauses do not apply to the kinds of transactions being complained about. And the reason is, they argue, and the government, the Department of Justice most recently has made this argument repeatedly in its legal filings. The reason they claim that the clause doesn't apply to these transactions is that the meaning of this term emolument is narrow and rigid, and it really is tied to payments or profits that arise out of an office or an official employment. And so what they mean by that is that what the Constitution forbids is the receipt of payments, or you might think of it as salary or compensation, that would be received by the president in the discharge of his official duties, not in what his businesses, his private businesses, might do in the marketplace, but simply a situation which he actually is exercising the duties of the office of the presidency and receives payments or compensation for doing that. And that's a very narrow reading of the meaning of the term. The plaintiffs in all three lawsuits are arguing for a broader reading. They are arguing that the term emolument actually was more flexible at the founding. It didn't simply mean salary or fringe benefits or the formal compensation that you receive for employment, but rather this more general definition that Judge Massetti, in fact, adopted in his opinion yesterday, and that is a term which refers to profit gain, advantage, or benefit of any type. And it would importantly include the profits from private market transactions. So that was one of the big issues at the in the case. The judge spent quite a lot of time and effort walking through some historical evidence, which suggests that the original public meaning of the term emolument at the time the Constitution was adopted was, in fact, the broader meaning pressed by the plaintiffs. So he accepted the plaintiffs' arguments in that regard and rejected the government's argument.
Well, the only time I recall anything like this happening in terms of a government or cabinet members who have to be confirmed was when Bill Casey was nominated by Ronald Reagan to be the head of the Central Intelligence Agency, and he was an investment banker from New York and had a considerable portfolio, and he was reluctant to put it into trust, but he eventually had to, for the obvious reason. If you're the head of the CIA, you get some pretty important information, you know. You could certainly trade on that. So that was the only case. Why is it that Trump and his family are such a break from tradition?
Well, that's the question, isn't it? We have a system that, generally speaking, relatively speaking, is quite good on these issues of public corruption. I mean, I think there are a lot of problems. Most listeners would agree, I think, a lot of problems with the United States, its government, its laws, its social policies, and there are differences of opinion on that. But in one respect, we've been leaders in the area of clean government, right? And this is one of our boasts, one of our things about which we're most proud, is that we have norms and laws that apply to every government official. No one is above the law. We're a government of laws, not of men, as John Adams famously remarked. And President Trump has, I think it's fair to say, thumbed his nose at these norms, customs, and laws. And beginning with the refusal to release his tax returns, which is not a law, it's not a legal requirement, but it had become entrenched as a kind of understood custom and norm that presidents and candidates for president complied with in order to signal to the public, I know that you care about transparency, I care about transparency, I know that not only conflicts of interest, but appearances of corruption and conflicts of interest are vitally important if we're going to have trust in our government officials, so I'm going to release my tax returns, release information about the workings of my businesses and so forth. Every president prior to President Trump has complied with those norms, and it's a very important thing. What President Trump and his family have done really right from the start is try to test the limits of each and every law, norm, and custom that applies to the presidency in this respect. And when it comes to the emoluments issue, he was counseled by certain officials, both inside government and outside of government, former ethics officials, about how he had to conduct himself if he was going to comport with the constitutional requirement. And really what it came down to was the question of divestment or blind trust or some legal forms in which he would be separated from his businesses in a really significant and decisive way so that these concerns about conflicts of interest and corruption and undue foreign influence would be addressed. And he refused to do so. In fact, as I think many people would agree, he's done the opposite. He has really turned his presidency into a giant cash register.
Well, John McCullough, I thank you very much for joining us here today.
Oh, you're welcome. Thank you for having me.
And again, I've been speaking with John McCullough, who's a professor of law and associate dean at Georgetown University School of Law, whose research focuses on constitutional law, international law, jurisprudence, moral and legal philosophy, legal history, and cognitive science. He previously served as a judicial clerk on the U.S. Court of Appeals for the 11th Circuit, and he's most recently co-authored an amicus brief in the District of Columbia and the State of Maryland versus Trump emoluments case. We're going to take a brief station break. We're back looking into the proposal put forward by Education Secretary Betsy DeVos to require that defrauded student borrowers seeking loan forgiveness prove that these for-profit colleges deceive them.
Baby, you're the rich man. Baby, you're the rich man too.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at backgroundbriefing.org. And joining us now is Aaron Ament, who's president of the National Student Legal Defense Network, who served in President Obama's administration as a special counsel for higher education issues and subsequently as chief of staff of the United States Department of Education's Office of the General Counsel. And prior to that, he was an assistant attorney general in Kentucky. Welcome to Background Briefing, Aaron Ament.
Thank you for having me, Ian.
And Betsy DeVos is now proposing essentially to place the burden on the students who have been defrauded by these for-profit colleges, and they've been saddled with insurmountable debt burden, a lifetime of debt, and worthless diplomas. And if they are going to seek some relief or some loan forgiveness, they have to prove that these colleges deceive them. And to my mind, that means that some poor veteran or some minority kid who thought he was going to get an education and a job, who is saddled with a lifetime of debt, is supposed to go out and hire an attorney to argue against these well-funded attorneys from these hugely government-financed for-profit entities that will have batteries of lawyers. I mean, isn't it pretty clear that the deck will be stacked against these kids?
Yeah, Ian, I think that's exactly right. I mean, yesterday we saw Betsy DeVos propose new regulations over these student loan discharges that really roll back the protections for defrauded student loan borrowers and make it nearly impossible for these former students to obtain debt relief. These are largely students, as you noted, from disadvantaged socioeconomic backgrounds, disproportionately students of color and veterans, often service members returning home from overseas. Tens of thousands of these are students who have, you know, returned from active duty, often Iraq, Afghanistan, to use the GI Bill and have been defrauded by these large predatory for-profit colleges. And these new proposals are really a giveaway to these predatory for-profit colleges, whose executives Betsy DeVos has hired into her administration. And, you know, while these companies continue to take hundreds of millions of dollars a year in revenue from the U.S. Department of Education and federal student aid funds, it's the taxpayers and thousands of these defrauded students who are going to be left holding the bag.
So how can the Republicans and people like Betsy DeVos get away with implying that somehow these for-profit colleges have something to do with the private sector, with the free market, when they're, I think, 99%, I don't know what the figure is, but it's over 90%, entirely subsidized by the taxpayers. And what's even more pernicious is that these fraudulent for-profit colleges are able to take our taxpayer money and advertise on television, which they do all the time. You keep seeing ads for DeVry and for Phoenix and all of these for-profit colleges. And obviously this is money that is both taxpayers' money and could be otherwise spent on the education of these kids. But it seems to be really focused on conning them into a situation where they take on debt, but not the for-profit colleges. And the for-profit colleges are all about profit, and the students are all about debt.
Yeah. Ian, I mean, you said it right. Over 90% of these companies' revenue is from the federal government. You know, they can get up to 90% of their revenue from the Department of Education, and there's no limit really as to what they can spend of that in marketing and TV advertisements. You mentioned DeVry, which advertised a 90% job placement rate that the Federal Trade Commission alleged, you know, was false dating back to the early 1970s. They had to settle that for over $100 million. And, you know, subsequently, Betsy DeVos came into power and hired an executive from DeVry to head up the very unit that was investigating DeVry and these other schools. You know, that new enforcement office has essentially been disbanded by Secretary DeVos and the Trump administration. And she has continued to really stack her administration with executives from DeVry and several of these other schools that were reportedly under investigation. The New York Times, I think, had a front page story a month or so ago into these very investigations that were being rolled back. But this really shouldn't be a Democrat or Republican issue. I mean, this is really an issue of government waste of hundreds of millions of dollars each year going out the door of the Department of Education to predatory companies who are spending that money on false advertisements. And now we see yesterday new regulations that propose students would not only have to allege that they were, you know, conned by these false advertisements into enrolling into the schools, but they would actually have to prove that the executives intended to make those false statements. I mean, how is a student, a former student, you know, able to prove intent with, you know, internal emails of a company? I mean, it is an impossible standard for students to meet. Even if they have the best lawyers in the country, I don't think you're going to be able to see, you know, students obtain the debt relief that they really deserve.
And again, I'm speaking with Aaron Ament, president of the National Student Legal Defense Network, who served in President Obama's administration as a special counsel for higher education issues and subsequently as chief of staff of the U.S. Department of Education's Office of the General Counsel. And prior to that, he was an assistant attorney general in Kentucky. So, if there's no way to generate a taxpayer revolt, because it's absolutely revolting, the idea that the taxpayers subsidize this racket, and it's particularly cruel that these minority students are saddled with a lifetime of debt and end up with these worthless diplomas. I mean, it seems obvious that our students should be centers of investment, not centers of profit. But this is even worse. This is kind of like a mafia operation where you just literally get ripped off, and it's the government. We're all complicit in it in as much as it's our taxpayer money. So why is it that that's not somehow getting through to the public? I would have thought that people, once they recognize that they're paying for this racket that's causing so much harm to a whole generation of kids and limiting their prospects and saddling them with a lifetime of debt, you'd think they'd be up in arms.
Yeah, well, I'm really hopeful that even, you know, at the state level, at least, we are seeing more and more attorneys general, many Democrats and some Republican attorneys general stand up to Secretary DeVos. And we've seen a few lawsuits filed over her, you know, delay in implementing the previous bar defense regulations and the gainful employment regulations that were enacted to protect students from attending these for-profit and career college programs that saddled them with debt. And, you know, we're seeing other state agencies and organizations like us at the National Student Legal Defense Network represent students and help them, you know, obtain debt relief that they deserve. And, you know, I think we're really starting to see it, you know, break through to the public in the aftermath of the collapse of Corinthian colleges that had several campuses. Out, you know, in California, where many of your listeners are, Everest College, Heald, and WyoTech, where thousands of students were defrauded. And, you know, hopefully these stories are being told. And that's why it's so important, you know, that people like you are able to shine light, really, on, you know, what's going on and, you know, how we can work to help, you know, many of these students obtain the debt relief that they deserve.
But clearly, because these for-profit colleges hire these powerful lobbyists and former congresspeople like Steve Gunderson, et cetera, they've got a lot of political clout. But you would think that somewhere or other, if we had sort of the kind of fiscal discipline that Republicans are often accusing the Democrats of lacking, what is it, between $30 and $40 billion a year goes to this racket. If you spent that money on community colleges and upgrading their facilities and staff, et cetera, wouldn't you really be getting an enormous value for your money instead of these crooks ripping off kids? As far as I can tell, these community colleges are underfunded, and they would welcome an influx of $30 to $40 billion a year.
Yeah, I couldn't agree more. You know, it has always been striking to me why fiscal conservatives haven't taken up this issue of just massive government waste of billions of dollars going to predatory companies. And I think you hit the nail on the head that, you know, it often has to do with their hiring of lobbyists, thousands of dollars in campaign contribution to members of Congress. But, you know, why is this not a libertarian issue? Why are members of the Freedom Caucus, even, you know, that champion fiscal responsibility, not standing up and saying enough is enough here? You know, what we are seeing are, you know, companies subsidized to 90% of their annual revenue with, you know, federal taxpayer dollars. And, you know, they're just funneling that into false advertisements, you know, luring students with false promises of hope, saddling them with debts that they have little to no hope of repaying, with really bleak job, you know, career prospects. And, you know, I'm still hopeful, you know, that we'll see, you know, several fiscal conservatives, you know, stand with Democrats maybe in the next Congress and propose legislation such as a strengthened 90-10 rule that would, you know, at least be strengthened to 80%, whereas, you know, instead of these companies being able to get 90% of their revenue from the Department of Education, you know, it could be lowered to 80% and, you know, not allowing them to, you know, make up the difference in GI Bill funds, which gives them an incentive to recruit service members and veterans. I am hopeful that we'll see, you know, people on both sides of the aisle, you know, join forces and really make this a bipartisan issue.
Well, what's particularly disgraceful is that Betsy DeVos is rubbing salt in the wound, because she's now she's making it next to impossible for these kids to get debt relief. And somebody mustn't like her, because her $40 million yacht was set adrift in a lake in Ohio. And I would like to know, and I don't know whether, I mean, I guess we're both going to speculate here. I thought she was a devout fundamentalist Christian, and I don't see what is Christian about the idea that you hurt people and impoverish them. What's the quote in the Bible? It's easier for a camel to go through the eye of a needle than it is for a rich man to enter the kingdom of heaven. So how do you think this moralistic person who wears her religiosity on her sleeve and is trying to change the Department of Education into, or at least trying to get more charter schools and more religious schools accredited, because she believes in religious education. Her children were educated in religious schools, as she was, and her husband, I believe. So their personal piety is manifest, but how does it gel with what she's doing?
Well, I can't quote the scripture quite as well, but, you know, I couldn't agree more that the actions that she's taking and proposing regulations, you know, like we saw yesterday, that make it nearly impossible for these defrauded students, you know, disproportionately students of color from disadvantaged backgrounds, veterans who have been defrauded, have little to no job prospects or ability to repay their loans, and in making it impossible for them to obtain debt relief, you know, I don't know really of, you know, any, you know, one's moral compass that, you know, yesterday's proposal would align with. And yeah, I think it really has a lot to do with, you know, not only her history of investing in companies or funds that operate for-profit colleges and hiring executives that have worked at these very predatory for-profit college chains, and, you know, giving them free rein to propose regulations like we saw yesterday. And, you know, I think really enough's enough. And I hope both Democrats and Republicans, you know, are ready to stand up and, you know, fight back against what we've seen out of Secretary DeVos and her administration.
So do you think that, I mean, I don't know that Trump himself pays much attention to what his cabinet members do. And obviously comes from a very wealthy Republican family. They've donated an awful lot of money to Republican candidates. So it's hard to know whether he's has any kind of input or has given her any direction. Her confirmation hearing was deeply embarrassing because she clearly didn't know anything about education. And she only squeaked by a one-vote margin. But what one wonders is, in terms of her agenda, is she satisfying Trump by simply going after what Obama did, which seems to be Trump's obsession? In other words, Obama and you guys during the Obama administration put through all these rules to protect students, and she's undoing them. So is that just that kind of reflexive mechanism that anything Obama did we have to undo? Or do you think she's genuinely on board with these predators?
You know, I don't know if I can speculate as to her motives, as much as just observing, you know, this is the president who operated a fake for-profit college, Trump University, who, you know, I think made donations to the Florida Attorney General to help muzzle an investigation into this, you know, phony Trump University. So I'm not surprised that we're seeing these actions out of an administration like this. But I think it really appears to me to have more to do with Secretary DeVos and her, you know, advisors that she's hired from many of these predatory for-profit colleges. At every step of the way since they've come into power, they've, you know, attempted to roll back protections for these student loan borrowers that would hurt the bottom line and the profit of these predatory companies. And, you know, that's a common theme that we've been seeing in all of their actions, delaying implementation of the gainful employment regulations that set metrics that for-profit colleges have to pass so that their graduates, you know, earn enough money to repay their loans, the ability of defrauded students to get loan forgiveness, and then limiting the ability of the department to obtain those funds back from the predatory for-profit colleges, which is even, you know, more mind-boggling to me that here you have the head of a federal agency limiting the agency's own power to recover the money that the agency's lost. You know, there's really no explanation for that other than a complete giveaway to the executives of these for-profit colleges. And, you know, I'm hopeful that, you know, at the National Student Legal Defense Network, I encourage everyone to come to our website, nsldn.org. You know, we're working with state attorneys general across the country and, you know, other nonprofit organizations. There's a clinic at Harvard's Law School that has done great work on this, the National Consumer Law Center, and just many, many other organizations across the country, Century Foundation and PCUS out in California, that have been joining forces to fight back, bring lawsuits, you know, get activists to step up and, you know, submit comments to these regulations, because DeVos's team has to respond to public comments. So going to the website at ed.gov and regulations.gov and submitting public comments as to, you know, why these regulations are so damaging to just tens of thousands of students who are defrauded out there, and, you know, forcing them to explain themselves, I think can go a long way in hopefully fighting back against the proposals that we saw yesterday.
Well, Aaron Ament, I thank you very much for joining us here today.
Thank you so much for having me.
And again, I've been speaking with Aaron Ament, who's president of the National Student Legal Defense Network, who served in President Obama's administration as a special counsel for higher education issues and subsequently as chief of staff of the United States Department of Education's Office of the General Counsel. And prior to that, he was an assistant attorney general in Kentucky. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program is available for podcasting at backgroundbriefing.org. You can also contact me, and I'll be back again with another Background Briefing. Bye for now.